and welcome to the Trash Tapes Podcast as part of the Enigmatic Productions Network. If you love bad cinema and incredible deep dives into cult film, then you have come to the right place. So if you like what you hear and want to support us, you can do so by donating some funds to our Buy Me a Coffee website, along with the Acast supporter feature. All of these can be found in the description below. And now, on with the show.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
To experience trash cinema. Oh my God.
And welcome to another episode of the Trash Tapes. One man's trash is another man's treasure. I am your host, Johan Chapal, and the Inflictor of Pain. And I am joined by my usual victim and DJ, Edward Harvey. Hi there.
Hello, Johan. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm okay. It's going to be an interesting one this week because obviously we're doing a very special episode, but also the fact that this is the first time we're recording the podcast, this time with my new look, which is predominantly just me removing all of my hair. Yeah. I've shaved my head. But what's interesting is this was around the time where we heard the news about Bruce Willis. And so it kind of feels appropriate that now I have no hair and we're now talking for the first time properly a Bruce Willis movie on this podcast.
Are you doing Bruce Willis cosplay now?
Give me a dirty vest. Just let me walk around grizzled. I might be able to pull that off, I think. We heard, obviously, that Bruce Willis was retiring. Okay. And to be honest, I think we kind of saw the signs a little bit, especially with maybe the last few years of his career, I guess.
Yeah. It certainly seemed like he was just racking up some money just so he didn't have to do movies anymore. Like, he just saying yes to anything just to accumulate a large sum of money to retire on, basically. That's what it seemed like.
Yeah, because he did a whole bunch of like straight to DVD movies for about 3 or 4 years. And you imagine, like, he's getting paid $1 million to just do 1 week's worth of acting in a movie, because that's what they usually are. Then if you can rack up like 10 or 12 of them in a year, you know. Yeah.
But before the whole news came out that he actually did have a problem with like early Alzheimer's and stuff like that, like memory loss and things like that, everyone was like making fun of him, thinking he was being a bit greedy and lazy, like doing these roles and stuff. Like, he hardly showed up, just did a few lines and they were cutting around him and stuff like that, and thinking, oh, this is annoying. When's he going to do proper roles again? But then we kind of understood when it all came out, didn't we? And we felt a bit sorry for him, really.
because people had mocked him for a bit, but there was some signs that, for example, like, he had to, like, for the last 5 or 6 years, he'd been using an earpiece to have people read his lines, for example. Or they just, like, he didn't move a lot. Like in terms of acting, he was mostly just standing up or sitting down in places. Yeah. So it was getting on a bit. Now, when we wanted to do this episode of the podcast, I mean, obviously we could have done any of the recent movies he's done because they are all awful. Like, there's one called Cosmic Sin, which is just absolutely, oh boy. But I saw that as thinking that's low-bearing fruit and kind of unfair.
Yeah.
So let's go back through his archive, because he has done some bad movies.
Yeah.
Right?
Definitely.
And why not do his passion project, his baby, the one that he grew from the ground upwards. Ladies and gentlemen, we're doing Hudson Hawk.
I just got out of jail yesterday. I didn't want to steal anything. I didn't want to go to Europe. All I wanted was a cappuccino.
You still think you're the greatest cat burglar that ever lived?
You are one hell of a thief.
Hudson Hawk is an evil, evil man.
The Big E.
I'm just some guy that's good at swiping stuff.
Eddie, we're hanging off a castle in the middle of Italy, and you're asking me how you look.
Okay, okay. You don't gotta get testy about it.
Look gorgeous. You look like Zorro.
Well, I didn't know.
Buongiorno.
Yeah, buongiorno. Maybe you could help me. I'm being blackmailed into robbing the Vatican by a psychotic American corporation and the CIA. You don't speak English? You have very beautiful eyes for a man.
I got a bad feeling. I can't even swim.
Hell, four will probably kill you.
Oh, I was afraid you weren't going to drop by.
You want to know something, Eddie?
What?
You hit like a girl!
Started the week by stealing the sports truck and ended up by swiping the Codex.
Yeah, but
what are your plans for the weekend? Hosting away the Coliseum?
Can't we just go back to the kissing part? Life doesn't get much better than this.
Yes. Hudson Hawk.
Hudson Hawk. When... Okay, so how do you know Hudson Hawk? Like, when was the first time you've seen it?
I saw it when it came out on video. To rent. So I guess that would have been, when did the movie come out? 91, 92? I guess it would have been like sort of like the year after it, because it come, they get videos, they came out about a year later, didn't they, on video?
Mm.
But yeah, it was one of those that I rented. And I kind of had fun with it back then, but I didn't, I was quite young and I didn't really understand what was going on. And as I've got older, I understand what's going on now, but I'm thinking, why is all this stuff going on? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you saw Election when it came out on video. I saw it many years later because Bruce Willis, this is the thing, Bruce Willis was realistically my childhood hero, right?
Yeah.
I saw Die Hard at the age of 8 when you really shouldn't be.
No.
And I thought it was the best movie ever made. He's the coolest person ever. I want to watch more Bruce Willis. So I started watching a whole bunch of Bruce Willis movies and so on. And then later on, when I found out that he used to have a music career and still kind of had a music career, you know, playing the harmonica basically in a blues band and calling himself Bruno. That's a whole skit. I heard about Hudson Hawk and I watched it. And I got a different reaction to you. I didn't think it was fun. I thought it was like, what the hell is this? Because, you know, I saw Action Man. Bruce Willis, right?
Yeah.
I saw the Die Hard Bruce Willis's. I saw the Last Boy Scout Bruce Willis. I saw that Pulp Fiction Bruce Willis, right?
Well, I saw all that as well, but I also saw things like, I remember when Moonlighting was on TV and I was like so young. I can remember like a vague memory of that, and that was a comedy. And also, I used to love the Look Who's Talking movies, and he did the voiceover for
the baby, didn't he?
That's a comedy. So I was familiar with his comedy work when going into this kind of thing. So
I think I always knew he was going to be funny. Like I always knew he was funny, but in an action movie, quippy funny, you know. Because when you compare it to the humor in this movie, it's.
I would say, though, some of his best performances are comedies. Like, how good was he in Death Becomes Her, for example? He's hilarious in that movie.
Yeah, he's really good in that, because I think it just it feels like he can be neurotic and just be a little all over the shop. And yeah, he's good in comedy. He's not saying he's not. But in this, well,
strange tone, isn't it? There's some like there's a lot of comedy bits, but there's some stuff in there that isn't funny at all, and it's like, what? Like, it's very violent in places. Like,
it is. It is. Do you know, actually, okay, I'll tell you this before we actually go into breakdown what the hell Hudson Hawk is, because I think our listeners are curious. There's a body count to this movie. Do you know how many?
No.
22 people die in this movie.
That's like a B action movie, isn't it? Kind of
it's
level.
Like, it's like a RoboCop level of death numbers, you know? This is supposed to be a slapstick heist movie. What the hell, Bruce Willis? What the hell?
And as a kid watching it, I couldn't kind of process that, and I just kind of skipped over the bits I didn't like, and just because as a kid you don't always watch a whole movie, do you? You just kind of watch bits that you like. Sometimes you might turn it off once you got to the bit that you like. You kind of you just watch that bit and then you turn the movie off. But nowadays we tend to watch the entire movie and process it like that.
Or sometimes, you know, when you watch a movie and you think you remember the bit, and then sometimes you sit there like, I forgot how long it took to get to the bits that I liked. I think it's a little bit with this. But yeah, for all the listeners out there who are saying, what the hell's a Hudson Hawk? Well, Hudson Hawk is a different thing. Bruce Willis can very easily explain why he's called Hudson Hawk. There's a very nice, sexy, little weird scene in the movie that does that.
Where'd you get the hawk?
Hudson in New York.
Where'd you get the name Hudson Hawk?
Well, the hawk is a slang word for the cold wind that blows in the wintertime. I grew up in a town called Hoboken, New Jersey, which is on the Hudson River, so Hudson River.
Hudson Hawk. And where did you get these?
Oh. I had a little accident around the house.
What happened?
I fell on some chickens.
Does it hurt?
Yes, they hurt.
Maybe I can make them feel better.
Okay. See what you can do.
But Hudson Hawk is a 1991 action comedy film, kind of goofball-y, kind of a heist caper and everything else, directed by Michael Lyman, who was basically, people might remember him as being the director of Heathers.
So it's a great movie.
It's a great movie, right? Remember, Heathers was actually his first feature film.
Yeah.
Which is mind-blowing. Mm. Then he made a second one. And then literally, this is his third feature film. So he hasn't been on the scene much. Bruce Willis obviously stars in the movie as the Hudson. But also, as well, he's also, for the first time, he also co-wrote the story for this with his longtime friend and partner, who was a musician, who found him in the 80s as a musician, his name being Robert Kraft.
Yeah, didn't he, like, he heard him playing in bars and stuff, and he was, like, really into it, and he had one song that was called The Hudson Hawk, didn't he? And like, and he would join in with his songs with on harmonica and things like that. And like, they became sort of friends that way. And it was it seems like it's one of these projects, you know, when you're young and you think, oh, what if we made a movie out of this? And it's going to have all this going on, have all that going on. And then the trouble is, those movies shouldn't really be made. They're usually like wacky, crazy ideas. But the trouble is, when celebrities have the means of making those ideas come to life, they just do it because they can. It doesn't mean that they should.
Exactly. Because this is the thing. These are two lifelong friends. And they had this idea for Hudson Hawk, like, you know, this screwball heist cat burglar character for a decade, right? They had this idea for a decade, and then once Bruce Willis was out of Moonlighting and got a little bit more popular with Die Hard and Die Hard 2, they thought, fudge it, let's try and do this, because I think he just really wanted to do it, and Robert Kraft also really wanted to do it as well. And so they wrote the story for that and then gave it to Joel Silver, another famous producer at the time, to say, like, let's make this movie. Because Joel Silver was already working with Bruce anyway on the Die Hard movies. So it's like, well, okay, you're gold. Brucey, you are gold. Come on in, and we'll get this other Michael guy who did Heathers. That's kind of a black comedy. That's what you're kind of going for, right? And then they just kind of merge together and go for a while from there.
Yeah, because the he's also credited as one of the composers as well, Robert Kraft. Like a lot, but him and Michael Kamen, who did awesome stuff like the Prince of Thieves score and things like that. So, like, he was a really good composer, but he's also got Robin Kraft in there as well doing the music, which is like, how can you have two composers? It's like, because the thing is, he couldn't have done the songs because the songs are all licensed big hits. So, I don't know. It's strange.
It turns out that Robert Kraft and Bruce Willis composed the theme song.
Right, okay.
So maybe that's where Robert Kraft falls in as composer. He just wrote the Hudson Hawk theme music.
I can't even remember that, though. I can't remember the theme.
What was the theme? Andy McDowell. So, she's in this.
It's weird. Like, they haven't got much chemistry, have they? It's like, it's a weird kind of, the love story element is quite weak because, well, for a start, there's not really much time for it to develop. It's just kind of thrown in there. It's just an added thing. But no, they haven't got a lot of chemistry. And then her lines are really awful. So it's just a bit strange, the whole love story element.
Well, I'll throw that into you because Andy McDowell wasn't the first choice. Okay. Right. So originally it was Isabella Rossellini. Was the first choice. Okay. She was originally cast. When the movie was delayed because of scheduling issues, she couldn't do it. So they got this woman called Maruska Detmers. I can't remember her name. I don't know who she is. But she's quite a sort of renowned sort of, I think, sort of French-Russian, like Netherlands actress, right, who moved to France. And she was quite renowned in the French scene. So basically, they wanted to have her, they wanted the original character of Anna to be this European hot chick, basically. But then, apparently, after a few days of being on set due to some chaotic issues, she had to leave shooting because she came with back problems. Like, like, she couldn't move her back. So then suddenly it's like, fudge it. Andy McDowell, she around? Let's get her in here.
Andy McDowell a star by this point?
Good question, because
she became bigger in the mid to late 90s, I think. I don't think she was huge at this point.
No, I don't think she was, because obviously, like, obviously things like Groundhog Day was 1993.
Yeah.
But she was in Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which is 1989. But really, it wasn't until like Groundhog's Day and Four Weddings and a Funeral you get to really know Andy McDowell.
She's got this, especially in this movie, she's got that sexy tone. Everything's like said really sexy. And it's like, stop being, you don't need to be sexy all the time. It's like every line, she's like, sexy. Yeah.
I wonder if that was a direction from them and say, like, can you just say everything like it's a sexy whisper? Everything. Even the stuff that isn't supposed to be sexy. And it's like, come on. Because there's a lot of reshoots, there's a lot of things happening, there were lots of things delayed, a lot of things were going on, and I think what happened was that Bruce Willis, who's main writer, star, producer, everything else, you know, felt like, I think basically, got so inspired by this that he constantly kept adding ideas to the script all the time. So it kept constantly changing, which annoyed quite a few people, including Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhard, who are still apparently best friends. But Richard E. Grant hated it so much that he dedicated an entire chapter to the production of this movie in his autobiography.
Yeah, I remember it didn't, because Mark Kermode quite liked this film. And he when he's met Richard E. Grant around about the time, he said, I'm actually one of the few people that likes this movie. And he really sort of gave him an insult back, saying, you're an idiot, like, for liking it. It's a steaming pile of shit.
Yes.
My favourite memory of Hudson Hawk, well, two actually. I remember watching the film, sitting next to Kim Newman in, I think it was the Odeon Leicester Square, huge cinema. Total silence in the auditorium except for me and Kim Newman laughing like geese. It was something that we enjoyed, and the more everybody around us didn't enjoy it, the funnier we thought it was. And I then remember Richard E. Grant coming on the Radio 5 show that I was doing at the time, and I remember saying to him in what I thought was a friendly way, you know, hey Richard, you know, you were in Hudson Hawk and that movie bombed, but I really loved it. To which Richard E. Grant said, it was a pile of steaming hot donkey droppings and you are an idiot.
Yeah, there we go.
Just imagine Richard E. Grant doing that, because he was wacky. But because all these ideas were thrown on the day of set, so the actors were getting annoyed because they couldn't really prepare anything the day before. Like, you know, you couldn't like read the script and get prepared for the scene or whatever. Mm. So they had to just wait and say like, what's new in the script, with Bruce Willis coming in like, hey, I've got this really funny joke. Follow along with me, why don't you? And Ridley Grant, who's like trained in like professional acting, really,
yeah,
would hate that. Would hate to go in saying like, follow my lead. And it's like, but you gave me a script. I've mastered the script. You gave me the direction. I'm using the direction. And then literally having everyone, the director, the Bruce Willis going, scrap that. We're doing this instead.
Yeah. I suppose it depends on the actors involved, because the last film we talked about, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, the similar thing happened, but they were all up for it and loving the chaotic sort of fast-paced energy of it, and they liked that. But I suppose in this film, sorry, these people just didn't like that, so.
I think the reason for this one is because I think, right, with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, the reason why that worked is because I think everyone was on board. Mm. Like, they knew things had changed, but everyone, other than Dennis Hopper, really, were all on board. Like, let's just keep going. Let's improvise. Let's do this quickly. Everyone was like, go team, right? Mm. So even in the chaos, they made something weirdly coherent. Here is basically just Bruce Willis coming in, strutting his stuff and saying, hey, man, I'm going to change this. Let's do this. And just scrapping whole ideas. And then the budget went over. So there were certain whole like locations that had to be scrapped because they run out of money in some cases. It got way overblown. And things got delayed and lasted longer because basically, as most of the time, it's like Bruce Willis was changing ideas on the fly. The director had a different opinion on certain things. Certain people had different ideas of what the character should be.
Yeah. And so it's a bit like Cobra, with like Stallone actually kind of getting involved in changing things when the director's kind of like just letting it happen, kind of thing.
Kind of, but yeah. I feel like with this one, it feels more like the director was at least trying to keep everyone happy. Mm. You know, while in Cobra, it just felt like Stallone walked in and was like, you're the boss, man. You're the boss. While the other director was, you know, he was young and he was fresh. And he actually said, like, the reason why he picked this one is because he was already a fan of Bruce Willis. He just wanted to do it because you get a big budget and you get to have Bruce Willis in your movie. So why not? You know, which for a young filmmaker, or like, this is only your third feature, of course you would jump at the chance.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, so, yeah, I feel like that's the case there. It's not like Cobra, where basically really it was all the Stallone show and everyone just went along with it. I feel like this case is just Bruce Willis throwing loads of ideas and hoping it sticks, and then the director trying to keep everyone else happy about Bruce Willis's instant add-ons to the movie.
When the movie started, like when I rewatched it a few days ago, I was so nostalgic for the intro logo. I've got a clip of it. How great is this?
Go on. Ooh. The TriStar.
Yeah, with the running Pegasus, like running towards the screen. It's like, it's one of the most nostalgic movie logos for me, that one. I absolutely love it. I don't think they're a thing anymore, are they? They kind of merge into another company.
They merged with Columbia Pictures. In fact, this was the Hudson Hawk was the very last movie produced entirely by TriStar Pictures before they merged with Columbia Pictures, right? Which was going through a similar financial difficulty. So basically, they were kind of relying on Hudson Hawk to be a hit.
Yeah.
Which, I guess, because the film lost so much money, Sony had to salvage TriStar by purchasing the remaining stock and then by reorganizing said company and putting it in together to become with Columbia Pictures. So eventually United Stars and everything else basically comes with United Stars when they were bought out by MGM, Columbia, and TriStar were then allowed to use their own logos and merge together. Mm. So in other words, then there was a big merger with Columbia, TriStar, bits of MGM, things of United Artists. It was a weird thing in the early 90s where all these things were now merging together. I think they were banking so much on Bruce Willis just selling this movie as being like, he just did Die Hard 1 and 2, some of the biggest action movies of the decade right now. They are so gangbusters. People are still looking at him from Moonlighting. People know him. He's getting there. Let's give him a passion project right up front. And people will come to it no matter what it is because it's Bruce Willis.
Yeah, but it's not always the case, is it?
Nope.
I mean, it's the way, I mean, the movie sets, I've got a clip of the opening.
Yes.
Because it's got this weird, almost Princess Bride kind of story time intro where you've got a narrator who you never get an idea of who this narrator is. It's just a narrator that appears, that he kind of bookends the movie and just sets up the whole link with Leonardo da Vinci. So let's just play that.
Go for it.
Long ago, the Duke of Milan commissioned a little-known artist to erect a mammoth statue of a horse. The time was 1481. The artist was Leonardo da Vinci. The guy on the donkey is just a guy on a donkey. Anyway, they called this statue the Sforza, and it was going to be the largest bronze statue ever built. But wouldn't you know it? War broke out, and bronze became scarce. So Da Vinci decided to create a machine to change common lead into bronze. But when Da Vinci finally turned this machine on, it was to give him something more than he expected.
They needed it, like, someone wanted a big statue of bronze, and bronze was hard to get hold of. Yeah. And he initially got this machine. Except put this machine together to, well, he wanted to make bronze out of lead, but it ended up making gold. And that's quite a dangerous thing, making gold, because everyone will want it. And it's, and then it becomes this weird, you get all these villains involved, and it becomes like, we want to dominate the world. There's too many villains in this movie.
Basically, what the movie is, right, it's a heist movie, it's a caper, it's a conspiracy movie, it's a secret society film, it's a historical mystery about the whole thing with Cloudpunk and Leonardo da Vinci having the ability to turn steel into gold. And you're sitting there going, listening to that on its own, you'd have no idea it was a Bruce Willis movie. You have no diddly squat that this Bruce Willis heist movie was going to come out of that.
It seems like a fantasy movie, or even like, because it's got like, it could even be a swashbuckling type movie from the way it's presented. It's got the font on Hudson Hawk is very much like a font on a swashbuckling movie when that comes in. And because of that era and stuff like that, you could imagine people start sword fighting and then going on a ship somewhere, like sailing away. You could imagine it happening.
Why do I feel like a Bruce Willis swashbuckling movie would be secretly one of the best movies ever made?
Why isn't it that?
Why isn't it like Bruce Willis the pirate? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
That's what we need. We need him in tights and swashbuckling away. It starts off like that and ends with the weird sort of Princess Bride book, mythical story, fantasy thing. But then literally after the whole in Leonardo da Vinci conspiracy theory about he's got this magical crystal that using the sun could actually turn steel into gold, it cuts a left field. And then now suddenly we see Hudson Hawk in the modern day just walking out of prison.
Yeah. So I've got a clip of basically as soon as he comes out of prison, his parole officer is offering him a job immediately. As bold as balls, just like in the prison. Just
he's
being
right there.
Just let's play that.
Go on.
Eddie. So the Hudson Hawk is finally getting out. Remember all the reporters that were here when you came in? World's greatest cat burglar. Now who gives a fuck? Got a proposition for you.
The answer's no, Gates, even if you're based.
Now listen, smartass. As your parole officer, I found you a job.
No way.
It's a terrific job.
An auction house.
One night's work and you're free. No checking in with a shrink. No more community service.
But I want to do community service. I want to teach a handicapped how to yodel.
I ain't stealing no more, Gates.
10 years later, you're still impressed with yourself. Same old coat, same old hat. Next thing, Todd.
From you, that's a very powerful statement. Look, aren't you supposed to stop me from committing crimes? You know, book them, Dan, or give a hoot, don't pollute.
We're not okay. Your wise guy.
See, I can set you up and send you back anytime I want. It's a very fine line between ex-con and escape con.
So.
Hey, Gates. Do it yourself.
Hey! He's got my key! I'll be seeing you, Hawk.
Also, you get the introduced to 90s cool Bruce Willis, like his outfit and stuff. Like he's got this black Stetson hat, he's got the trench coat, he's got multiple earrings, like on one ear he's got lots of earrings on the lobe, and he's got those little round sunglasses that were proper in the 90s as well. And when I saw it as a kid, I thought he looked so cool. I thought this is really cool, that look.
Do you know what's the thing, Ryan? This is going to be something I think I'm going to really emphasize while watching this movie. I look at that Bruce Willis in the outfit, and I think that's just how Bruce Willis dresses like.
Yeah.
You know, that is the most Bruce Willis. His pant jeans kind of, you know, up to the belly button, tucked in shirt, leather waistcoat sometimes, jacket. He's got the hat. He's got the sunglasses. He's walking off. He thinks he's cool. He thinks he's like the coolest blues musician. If you ever want to find out how Bruce Willis is like as a person, as a personality, as what does he like and dislike, what does he find funny and not find funny, what's his music taste, if you want to really find out Bruce Willis the person, Hudson Hawk is like 1,000% Bruce Willis personality the movie.
Well, one of the interesting things about this film, if you notice, it's well, I only really noticed this when I saw it this time. The whole movie is just driven by Hawk. He just wants his cappuccino.
Yes! The running joke!
Right, so listen to this.
Just get me to the five toe, Tommy. I'm going to get a cappuccino soon. I'm going to strangle somebody.
You still got a thing for those unmasculine European coffees.
No, can I say?
Unmasculine.
Who's your buddy?
The man knows. So, Mr. Coffee, you having any trouble checking out?
Not much. Gates just tried to blackmail me into doing a job.
That donut hole eating son of a bitch take it in the ear for a beer. Rat bastard!
Had the perfect amount of foam.
Come on, I'll get you 10 of them back at the
perfect amount of foam.
The reason why I want to play that clip as well is because it's got an example of Tommy. The actor, what's his name? Danny Elio.
Danny Elio.
Yeah. He has like two levels of his performance. And in lots of movies, he does the likable kind of calm tone. But then now and again, that bit where he goes, rat bastard, like that. He goes up to that level or he goes to the calm level. Because he's also in Jacob's Ladder as well. He's in Jacob's Ladder. And there's a bit where Jacob is in like the hospital and he's his chiropractor and he goes to like rescue him and take him out of the hospital. And he does the same thing in that movie. There's a scene where he goes, "This is barbaric." And it's the same as that rat bastard kind of level. He does like those two. It sounds like I'm really making fun of his ability because he just seems to have two levels. But some actors are like that, aren't they? They have this one sort of thing they like to do often, but then they switch it on now and again and go explosive. And go to
it's like quiet, bang. Yeah. Look, he does have two switches in this movie and they are funny. But I'll tell you one thing though. Can I just say that basically Tommy Fivetone and Bruce Willis's character, they're one of the best things in the movie because their chemistry has more sexual chemistry than Bruce Willis and Andy McDowell.
You're right. That is the strength of the movie. And I really just wanted that. I wanted it to be a fun crime caper movie and somehow like they have to do these jobs. But, like, I don't need all the Da Vinci type stuff. I just want them to be, like, back in the game. And they're a little bit older now, but they're having so much fun doing it. And that you do get elements of that. But I just want the entire movie to be like that.
They've been friends for years. So when the character was written, Bruce Willis said, "I want him. Because I've known him for years and we could banter like hell and they could improvise and act like friends because they are friends." And it just, It means that when I listen to them, it just feels like this is great. This, like I said, this has more sexual chemistry than Bruce Willis and Andy McDowell. And
yeah, it's bromance stuff, isn't it, going on?
Full bromance. Like, they love each other. Like, they will do anything for each other. And it's even the thing, like, I love the bit later on in the movie where Andy McDowell almost teases that Bruce Willis is going to go to bed with him. And then she does and just gives him the pillows. And you can see Five-Tone going, "Ooh, look what you're doing! You're joining me on the sofa, like a bunch of girlfriends."
I know, and I love the fact that he's absolutely pissing himself laughing, seeing like Bruce Hawke's character like fail at like swooning.
Yeah,
it's a very special night.
Yes, it was.
Is
was. There's some things you don't know about me.
Even there's some things I do know about you, and about me, and about that bed.
Another time, Hudson.
Look, can't we just have a late night cappuccino?
I'm sorry, but the machine's still set up a poisonous foam.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
Good night.
Good night. Don't even think about it. Don't say another word. It's a very special night.
Fish funny, you're fish funny, Tom.
Yeah.
Great. It seems like they're genuinely having a right laugh at that moment. Mm. Like it's real, you know?
And that's the thing, that they are the most authentic thing in the movie. So everything involving just those two are probably the great part of the movie. Unfortunately, it does feel like it's bogged down by everything else.
We meet Frank Stallone in the Five-Tone, Tommy's bar.
Yeah.
And he's the one that kind of forces him to do the job, the auction house job.
To try and find the horse, basically, that we mentioned at the beginning
of
the movie.
I love this clip because it's kind of a dig at Sylvester Stallone. Listen to this.
Go on.
Cute shot, Eddie. Caesar Mario, Anthony Mario. I didn't know the circus was in town.
Stop. Why won't you do the auction house?
Call me superstitious, Caesar. I don't like to commit a crime within 24 hours of getting out of the joint.
Very simple. There's a safe on the seventh floor. You take their thingy and you put it in this thingy.
Directions even your brother could understand.
Yeah. Directions even I could understand.
Shut up. I thought that was quite harsh towards Sylvester Stallone, but it's, yeah.
It does feel like a slight dig. Because the whole point is, remember, they got the Mario Brothers, which also, there's another weird random thing with, there's another reoccurring joke, which I think only Bruce Willis finds funny, is that he's been in prison for so long, he has no idea what a Nintendo is, right?
Yeah.
And those two brothers are literally called the Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you are, it's like, sure, I think Bruce Willis is like, oh, this is going to be hilarious. The man who's saying like, hey, look at the Mario Brothers over here, and he doesn't know what a Super Nintendo is. Ooh!
I know. That's just so silly. I didn't even think about that, actually. I didn't think about that connection.
Yeah, because it's an ongoing thing. I think at the very end of the movie, I think Andy McDowell goes to Bruce Willis and is like, hey, if you want to, we can just spend all night playing Nintendo.
Anna?
Yes, that's...
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Will you play Nintendo with me?
I can't think of anybody I'd rather play Nintendo with.
It's all the jokes that Bruce Willis loves. This is this kind of weird sort of, I wouldn't want to call it dad humor. It feels a bit like your dad trying hard to say a joke and really putting the effort in. It's like, or no, not your dad, your uncle. That's different, because your uncle can say really bad jokes and then he sort of sits there expecting, going, huh? Yeah. Call back?
And you don't want them to make them feel bad, so you kind of like laugh a little bit, like fake laugh going.
You're like, ha, funny. Yeah. Oh, God, that was terrible. Can we talk about this scene, which is probably the most famous scene in the movie and probably my favorite scene in the whole movie, where the actual heist happens and they're sneaking in and they do all the banter going into the museum. And so there's a weird ongoing thing. Again, another ongoing joke where Bruce Willis seems to magically know the lengths of songs.
Yeah,
right?
It seems like he's... he's obviously been doing this for a while and he's memorized a lot of songs and the length of the songs. And he just, I don't know, this just seems like a really odd thing. It's just almost like to make him charismatic. He seems to want to time the jobs while singing along the songs to get the timing done within that time frame. And this particular job is they decide to go with Swinging on a Star because that's how long it'll take to do the job.
And, which is about 5 minutes 37, I think it is, or something like that.
So I've got a clip of just the when that starts.
Yeah.
We got about 5 minutes and change.
5:32, Swinging on a Star.
You know, they invented something while you're inside. It's called a watch.
Hey, Tom. Come on.
But what I love is when Bruce Willis starts singing, the joy on Tommy Five Tone's face when he sees, oh, we're going for it, here we go. He's like so having so much fun from that point onwards and then just kind of goes along with Hawk's kind of energy. And then that's what like makes the scene great. And like, so much so that towards the end, Tommy's so loud and into it, he slides into the scene. Remember that? He slides in. I've got a clip of that bit as well.
Go for it. All the monkeys on in the zoo. Every day
you see quite a few. You can hear his shoes like squeak then, because Tommy slides into shot, full voice, singing, belting out the song. And I'm thinking, these guys, right, they're cat burglars, and how loud are they?
They literally don't care at this point. They're having a whale of a time. As a timing mechanism, this is kind of cute. It's the cute thing. Because in all heist movies, they have like, what's the weird selling point of this heist, right? Because you can't just, you know, with Ocean's 11, is like all the double turns and all the double turns and the twists where you look at the heist has already been done and everything else. And if you look at other heist movies, it's like, are we going with brute force? Are we going with masks or whatever? This one is... they do everything in song, which is honestly really cute. And I feel like this is Bruce Willis's excuse to show off his musical chops, because remember, this it was him and his musical buddy who wrote this. So I think, like, I want people to know that I can sing. You know, people forgot my Bruno album, so I'm gonna sing the tunes here. And he's having so much fun. They're having so much fun. By the end of it, you can see when it finally is the last number, like they're doing jazz hands and dancing right at the very end, and it's adorable.
There's also a lot of like dated comedy in this movie, and like I'll give you an example, like the security guards when they're just kind of bored in the booth. There's got this bit. Remember this bit?
673 wongs in a phone book.
It's a hell of a lot of wong numbers.
God's sake. And that's so cringe, isn't it? That kind of thing.
But this is the thing as well. Like, if you imagine that this is like inside the mind of Bruce Willis, you know Bruce Willis would have found that absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
He would have sat there going, that's funny.
He even put a bit in the score, though, to emphasize the joke.
Fucking hell, you know? Like, we get it. So much wong.
The whole music timing thing, I really wish that was like all the way through the movie. Like, for example, even if it's not just on a job, for example, say some people came to his apartment and they wanted to kill him, for example, in one scene, and he was doing a fight scene in time with a song, and kind of like, and it wasn't even a job at that point. It was just the fact that he was timing all the fight by a song. I'd love that. I'd love to, if there was more of that kind of stuff.
Do you know what, though? Just saying that, we've already got a movie like that. It's called Baby Driver.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, Baby Driver was amazing that way. Imagine if this was done during that time with Bruce Willis going, right, okay, so basically, I love music, and I love this kind of music. I love the 40s, 50s, 60s crooner music. Everything's crooner music. And I sing it everywhere. But I organize everything through this. And that'd be awesome. Every fight scene, every caper, even things like romantic seduction could be like the music plays, like, right, 5 minutes 37, plays a song on. It's like, that's how long it's going to take me to seduce you. And you're like, yeah!
it could even be like cheesy, like you could break the fourth wall and like even sort of talk to the audience when a song is going to start and stuff, and like, and I'd love that. Like, I think that would be hilarious.
I think that would have worked with the comedy and the tone that I think Bruce Willis was really wanting to go.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I feel like that's working, because everything else gets really weird by the end, because he jumps into the apartment, literally, and we go to Frankie Stallone's apartment, where we suddenly get introduced to Alfred, AKA the butler.
He's a very scary character. Yeah. I've got a clip of that as well, because, you know, I mentioned like how violent the movie is, and you've got the dirty parole officer that told Bruce Willis about the job.
Yeah.
He's in this scene and he's getting a bit mouthy and he's like, he's obviously asking about where his money is. And let's just hear that.
Go for it.
You son of a bitch. I stuck my neck out setting this up for you limey bastards. Now where's my cut?
So much for his cut. Forgive my dry British humour.
Da 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 da.
So, yeah, you're getting a very violent throat slash in that scene. And it's jarring after such a great comedy scene, you know?
And you know what's weird, though? And this is going to be basically the whole movie, right? It's a thing I've been trying to battle watching this movie again. Who is this movie for? Now, okay, so who is this movie for? The movie is too childish to be fully for adults, right? Because a lot of the humor is cringy dad humor and sometimes really childish cartoon humor, which we will get to once we get to the Mayflowers, by the way.
Yes.
And the Candy Cub, but we'll talk about them in a second. It's too violent for kids, so it's not a family movie, because there are 22 people that die horrible deaths. And it's too mature, and it's swearing, and it's and there's a couple of cunnilingus jokes.
It's odd, and it's like, I think if this movie was made today, I mean, it probably wouldn't be greenlit today, but if it was made, all the violent adult stuff will be cut out, and it would be just like a 12A kind of movie. It wouldn't, there's no reason for it to have the adult stuff in it, you know? It's because the majority of the tone is the comedy stuff, so why is it, is the violence there and the swearing and the odd sort of adult jokes and stuff, why are they there?
Like, I don't know. And this makes me think, who is it for? Because it's too immature to be for adults. It's too mature to be for families. It sometimes takes itself too seriously to be a full-blown goofball comedy. And the comedy is so lame and interjects with the serious stuff that it constantly clashes. And I realize who this movie is for. It's just for Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
This is literally, Bruce Willis is probably sitting in his thing and going like, this is the best movie he's ever made, right? This is him projected directly onto screen.
And his buddy, Robert Kraft, perhaps, maybe?
Yeah, maybe it's literally, it's both of them.
Yeah.
This is them projected, right? And they just want to put everything they love into it, from caper movies to goofball comedies from the 1940s to all the serious action stuff that Joel Silver's very good for, which I wouldn't be surprised if he came and going like, they need the blood, they need the action. You're an action star. We need to put the action in. So, okay, Joel. So we'll do a couple of throat cuttings and some nice stabbings, why don't you? So, okay, then we'll do some explosions, okay? Are you happy, Joel? Whatever. And then you got the quirkier creative stuff, which I assume is from Michael Lehman, who goes over and says, like, I do dark comedies, so can I do some dark humor in here? And Bruce Willis is probably going like, sure, I like dark humor. You did Heathers. You know what you're doing.
I mean, the difference is Heather's script is absolutely amazing. So.
It's such a good script. I think that's the thing. Is like, you could get the best director for the job, but if the script is crap, it's not going to work, which is what happened here. So the movie's not made for anyone. So when this happens, like all this jarring stuff like that, you're saying that's for someone else, but it's not really if you're watching the grand scheme of things.
Hey,
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Soon after this, we go to the auction house.
Yes.
And do you remember the auctioneer is the guy from Coronation Street?
Oh my God, it is!
He was Fred Elliott in Coronation Street. I've got a clip of him just for the nostalgia of Coronation Street.
That's amazing.
And finally, lot number 17. Thought to be lost in the war. And again, last night. The Da Vinci Sforza, the jewel of the sale. Fantastic.
Is looking like a constipated warthog a prerequisite for getting a job in the art world?
Dottoressa Anna Baraglie of the Vatican. Doc?
Some of us warthogs are more constipated than others.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the scene also where you're introduced to the Mayflowers, isn't it? So we can talk about them, I guess.
Yes, okay. Can I talk about the Mayflowers? Because they are both the best thing in the movie and the worst thing in the movie.
I don't think they're the best thing at all. I hate them.
I mean, like, they are amazing, but not in this movie. Like, if you imagine them in a completely different movie, right? I know it's going to sound really dumb, but in a completely different movie, they'd be the best thing because they are eating it up. They are full ham. Not even ham. It's a ham and cheese sandwich deep fried in lard. It's so big.
They're almost like a Tim Burton couple. Like a Tim Burton. They're so surreal and wacky. It's like it's something from a Tim Burton movie. It's odd.
And it's kind of teased. Like they're a couple, but they're not a couple. Or are they? Are they brother and sister? Who knows? It's all kind of up there with them.
Waldo! Oh! 100 million clams!
$100 million to Mr. Darwin Mayflower.
100 million and one, Waldo!
Fantastic. $100 million and one.
I bid by mine own wench, Kel Balmer.
Don't hate me, baby. Funny.
Any other people?
Yeah, they're the show off. They're made of riches because basically they are the ones. They're the real bad guys because realistically what happens is the horse was already swapped out with a fake horse or a horse that's a whole, it's an over elaborate scheme to get all the pieces of the horse.
Yes.
Right? Get all the pieces of the horse, which inside the pieces of the horse and a few other things are the pieces of the crystal that has the gold making machine. Right? That's quite literally the point of it all. But basically, so they're just there trying to find the stuff. And so they do the auction and that's when you first introduce them being this big outlandish thing. And so it's, they, at the end of the day, it's like they kind of want to keep Bruce Willis alive and we'll explain why in a moment. But in the meantime, while we got those bad guys happening, we later find out when the whole thing's going off and they're trying to hide around and doing some stuff, that Anna, who played by Andy McDowell, secretly is an undercover nun for the Vatican.
It's so what? Don't need that in there at all, do we? It's annoying.
It's more convoluted nonsense than any right to be. So basically, she's a secret agent for the Vatican, because the Vatican owns a lot of Leonardo da Vinci's stuff, and they don't want anyone to try and rob the stuff. So she's there to be sure that no one robs the stuff, basically.
Yeah, and at first, obviously, they think that Hudson Hawk is wanting it for himself, like all these things that he's trying to... So they see him as a real threat and an evil man kind of thing.
He's
and
then evil.
She obviously realises after a bit that he's being forced into it, you know?
He's being manipulated by the Mayflowers, which happens a little bit later on in the movie. Because when this happens, onto the thing, then the other part, which I find quite interesting, because, okay, so the way they get the horse, the payment goes, I love this bit, because we forgot about this. Once it goes like, sold for $1,001,000,000, and people go like, no, don't do it. He drops the gavel. The guy explodes.
Yeah, okay? Fred Elliott from Coronation Street explodes.
And it's a nasty explosion because you can see the dummy, and the dummy explodes into loads of tiny pieces, and he's in flames, and you're like, Jesus! The explosion caused a lot of havoc. Bruce Willis gets knocked out. He's in an ambulance, and then we get this really ridiculous, kind of fun, but also really goofy ambulance scene.
Yeah, I've got a clip of that. I know it's mostly visual, but I wanted to play it because we've also got Frank Stallone being so wacky, like a comic book villain. At the beginning of that scene. So I've got just a little bit of that where the beginning of the scene with the mob goons, and then also the bit where Hawk is on the stretcher going through the toll booth. I just had to...
Oh my God, that's amazing. I love that scene.
Could just play along, could you, Eddie? Hey, hey, that's it, Eddie. Clancy, where you going on our tracks, eh? That auctioneer ought to be landing at LaGuardia any minute now. Hey, subtlety is not one of our strong points.
Oh, yeah, that's a bit all the needles go in his face.
I'm not going to lie, I kind of really laughed at this scene. He does it
so
perfectly.
So I know that's mostly just action stuff that you can't really see, but the main part is the fact that you hear him saying, toll booth, exact change.
Change, and he's running for the pockets, he throws it, and he does it. And you know what? That's a funny joke.
Yeah.
Because he's literally on the stretcher going through the power of his own will. There's also like weird other jokes, like literally this random couple who are driving say, hey, mister, are you going to die? It's like, excuse me? What the hell?
And that's an example of Bruce being kind of wacky. Because in that one, he isn't serious at all in that scene. He's kind of as animated as the Mayflowers almost, isn't he? Kind of really crazy, especially when he gets the toll booth thing right and he's laughing like manically to himself, like, ha, like that. Like, I've done it. I did it, kind of thing.
And it ends on an over-elaborate explosion where I think basically the Mario brothers are dead now. There is no one up on Magic Mushroom for that one. And so they've died in a horrible explosion, which then leads introduced to another set of baddies. Which
the CIA people, yeah.
The CIA people, George Kaplan and the Candy Bar Gang, basically.
I know, I just find them, I don't like them. I find them annoying.
They're all stereotypes. They're all stereotypes of something. But one thing I do love is like they're all named after famous American candy bars. So you've got Kit Kat. That pie is being played by David Caruso, aka Mr. CSI Miami Man himself.
Yeah. He's like a mime, isn't he?
The best mime. Like he's basically undercover agent, mime, copy, mimic, whatever you want.
But he talks to people in cards, and how does he get them prepared so quickly? Like they're exactly what he wants to say at that moment on a card printed.
You then got Almond Joy, and she's like the serious one, right? You've then got Snickers, who is the smart one, and then you've got Butterfinger, who, I'm not gonna lie, I know he's a horrible stereotype of just jock manly girl, right?
Yeah.
Because he's big and butch. But I found him so funny. But funny in like a sitcom way. Like, if he was in a sitcom, I'd laugh the hell out of it. Because he says all the dumb stuff. He's a bit thick. Well, yeah. He's very thick.
But there's a bit, and, though. Do you remember there's a very inappropriate line? Basically, as we're talking about him now, I'll play it now. But they're on a stakeout outside Andy McDowell and Bruce Willis, like the apartment, her apartment. They're outside. And Butterfinger just says this.
What's going on in there?
You want me to rape him?
What?
Yeah, just read your book, Butterfinger.
What? Oh my God, so dark.
Not in a boat, not on a train.
That sounds how thick he is. I don't think he knows what that word means.
I do not like yourself. Queen
to yourself.
Yeah, why? Why would they put that line in there? That is so weird.
It's shock. That is an example of just dark shock humor for the sake of it.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's not even funny. Like, excuse me?
See, even other actors in the scene are like shocked by it. There's a big silence after he says it.
It's like, just read a book. Like, honestly, read a book. And also coming out of the dumbest character as well, which makes me feel like, ugh. It's so gross. But yeah, they are all them. And then you've got George Kaplan, who, interesting fact, by the way, just throw one of my facts out there. George Kaplan, right, is the fake agent name used by Cary Grant in North by Northwest.
All right, cool. Yeah.
So this is the thing where Bruce Willis is trying to make obvious references to movies he likes. So he likes North by Northwest. He's like To Catch a Thief and all that stuff. And he's trying his best to make it this way, but he just can't think of a tone. Because when he's introduced, George Kaplan, he's introduced as the head of the old CIA. I love how he introduced him. It's like, you remember me last time, but I had different. I had no hair and a very long mustache. It's like, oh, it's like you were just a whole totally different person.
You like the company's new look? I call them the MTVIA.
George, you promised no old CIA, new CIA jokes.
Punks. They think the Bay of Pigs is an herbal tea and the Cold War has something to do with penguins.
Don't I know you?
The last time you saw me, I was bald with a beard and no mustache. And I had a different nose. So if you don't recognize me, I won't be offended.
My high school science teacher?
I'm the guy who tricked you into robbing the government installation and then had you sent to prison for it.
George Kaplan. I'm not the type to hold a grudge, George.
Ah, I used you as a diversion. I guess down deep I was just jealous. You were one hell of a thief.
I love the scene, actually, when he meets up with him in Rome. And he's really nostalgic about Rome. And he goes, I did my first barehanded strangulation here.
This was the good old days when there were fucking commies to kill. It's like good old fashioned everything. Oh, you old boomer.
I thought that was a funny scene, actually. There are some bits that actually did make me laugh.
This is the thing, though. There are bits that will make you laugh, right? But it feels very random. Like, I think I like Butterfinger most of the time because he's an idiot. Like, the first time he introduced to him, he's literally, he's dragged an entire porta potty around him. He slips and he goes, my name is Butterfinger. It's like, of course. And then Bruce Willis goes, of course you are. You know, I get that. It's funny. But then there's other bits in between. This is where we're then properly introduced to the Mayflowers at the scene where we see him in the big, like, fucking, like, meeting hall where they get Bruce Willis in, and it's really funny because basically you got Sandra Bernhard singing I've Got the Power.
Oh, it's just so, that really annoyed me.
I love it. Oh, everything she does is annoying. She is annoying, admittedly.
And also when they're in Rome, you get an example of the cringy kind of sexy voice of, you know, when like they have the date.
What?
I am the waiter, sir.
Oh, very nice. Fettuccine con funghi porcini, prego.
Benissimo, signore.
Oh, and bring me a bottle of ketchup with that, will you?
You heard him.
Ketchup sulle tagliatelle. Stupidi americani, come fanno a mettere ketchup sulle tagliatelle? Non capisco, ma come cazzo?
Molto bene. They had the worst ketchup when I was in prison.
Prison?
I was a warden.
How long were you in?
Let's just say I never saw E.T.
Ooh, that was a while.
Wow. You were in the joint, doing hard time.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, but that excites me.
Oh, does it now?
I seem to have a thing for sinners.
Well, I seem to have a thing for sinning. Check, please.
Actually says check, please. That's like such an obvious kind of joke to have in like a restaurant scene, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, this is the thing as well. Like the thing we know eventually is that we've discovered that Annie McDowell is an undercover nun for the Vatican to try and stop the whole thing happening. And the whole idea is that she thinks the best way to like stop him from doing any crime is to literally try and seduce him. But she can't do it. And so she's playing coy because she is a nun, right? Yeah. So she can't break the vow of her sistership. So he's basically cock blocking the entire thing all the time. Like it gets hot and steamy and then she says, I can't do it. But not like whatever it is. But then there's moments going like, I can't do this, and goes back to, but I must, but I can't, but I must, but I can't, but I must, but I can't.
Yeah, because she just seems to actually like him. But at the same time, it's weird because there's not a great deal of natural chemistry. Mm. It's like it's hard to kind of see that. It's almost like, well, the plot says that she's supposed to like him, so I guess you're supposed to believe it, but
it's kind of flat. So when they do end up getting together, you're thinking, is it just because the plot says so? They get together now? Sure.
Listen, this might be hard to believe, but I'm just a regular Joe. I just want to be happy. And happiness comes from the achieving of goals. It's just that when you've made your first billion by the age of 19, it's hard to keep coming up with new ones. But now, finally, I got myself a new goal. World domination! Shut up! Bunny, quit that.
Bunny ball ball.
I think Bunny's got today's ball balls.
Bad Bunny.
Oh, Bunny, you weren't that bad. Just two more minutes. I was so close.
So the Mayflowers have basically said, hey, look, right? We're going to kill you and all the people you love and everyone else, including your buddy, you know, Five Tone and everything else, if you do not go and try and rob the Leonardo da Vinci's codex from the Vatican, right? Yeah. Which is, oh, okay, we're going back to the heist. Cool. So he ends up going around the Vatican, having a look, trying to find the codex and writing a list of random objects and everything else. And he ends up with a cool sequence because they find out the Vatican has its own underground, like, railway system for the post. Mm. So he takes full advantage of that, hiding in a box that goes into the Vatican, launch himself out, and then do things like with a beach ball and with rope and with like mirrors. And it's good. It's fun stuff. Why do I not have more of this, please?
Yeah, but it wasn't timed to a song or anything, which I wanted more of that. Like every heist, I wanted to be timed to a song. Just me, but...
No. I feel like that should have had a song as well. Yeah. I think maybe the reason why he didn't have a song with it because he didn't have his partner in crime, maybe. Mm. Maybe he needs to be a double act. He sees him and his buddy being a double act, and when he's doing it solo, can't sing, he can't feel the joy, he can't get into it, he can't get into the flow. He needs his bouncing buddy, he needs his bromance, baby. Yeah. And he ain't getting it. So he does eventually end up robbing the codex with ease, actually. Like, this wasn't difficult. And, like, you'd imagine it with the Vatican to be quite difficult, but it wasn't that hard.
No, he just yanked it out there with a fishing rod, doesn't he?
Yeah, basically, he uses the mirrors. So he uses a bunch of mirrors so that the lasers don't go off. Then he throws a fishing rod, grabs it before the security thing falls on top of them. And then he just bolts and lands directly in time to that date.
Yeah.
Tommy Five Tone's back. He turns out he was double-crossing him, but wasn't really. It was all this to get a ploy, and there's an even more elaborate plan for them to escape the Mayflowers so they can do the mission themselves by faking their death and going into a fake ambulance that goes to the Vatican that gets Annie McDowell, and all three are now back together to stop the Mayflowers doing the thing, and I'm already tired.
Yeah.
Ed, I am very tired. This is, the movie's only 90 minutes long and so much is happening. I feel like I need to have the like a beautiful mind thing. I need to write on the windows, trying to find all the links.
Okay, I'm very confused by what's going on here.
Well, this is around that time as well when they gas them all, and when they come around, they have weird side effects from the gas, don't they? And like Andy McDowell's character starts talking very odd, but she's actually quite funny in that scene. I'll play a clip from that.
Go for it.
I don't know. It must be the Karari. It's been known to have certain side effects.
Oh, really, George?
I feel like a dolphin who's never tasted melted snow.
Listen. The apprentice's diary contains a code that explains how the three pieces of crystal fit together. If you could do us the honor and decipher how the code works, we would be eternally grateful.
What does the color blue taste like?
Bubble knows.
I must speak with the dolphins now.
Just shoot her. Anybody? Darwin, this is supposed to be torture, not therapy.
Oh, that hilarious. Dolphin impression is great.
Oh, she knows how to do a dolphin. You can't lie about that.
Yeah, I'm just remembering, it's not a gas, is it? It's the dart, isn't it? It's the like the dart that knocks them out, because there's that scene where they kind of like they're coming back around, and they're kind of like Tommy's sort of his hand sort of become more animated. He can move his hand again, and like, and then they eventually kind of are able to get out of that situation.
Because there's another scene here, basically, after that happens, because they all get darted, and it's basically keeps them paralyzed for a small amount of time in the apartment. And then you've got George Kaplan and all of the candy bar gang, all sort of waiting and raring to go to try and just say, right, you know, you double crossed us, you shouldn't do that, blah blah blah. And so Snickers tries to get out this weird ass rocket launcher, which is hilarious how this works.
Guys, we got some good news and some bad news.
The good news is you'll be completely unparalyzed in about 2 minutes.
Bad news is that leaves you only 5 seconds to defuse the bomb.
Bombs? And I do kind of find the scene funny, because eventually he gets Bruce Willis and everyone else gains ability to kind of move their legs a bit, and they're still kind of stiff as they're running around like so. He trips him up. The rocket bounces off the side of a wall, hits him in the face, and because it's a sticky rocket grenade, he's like holding it like, oh no, oh no, before he explodes, and Danny Aleo just kind of just jumps out of the balcony and it's fucking brilliant.
But it wipes out most of the candy bar gang, doesn't it?
It kills Almond Joy and Snickers with just a giant explosion. But it's just kind of funny, because both of them are trying to run out of the balcony. You can see this, like I said, they're slowly trying to regain their fingers and moving stuff. So they're just like, they're trying to stretch the entire time.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny before it gets into that. But again, that's another sign of like the cartoon violence that's happening here. Like, it's hard violence. A man explodes, right? But it's cartoonish because it's a bouncing grenade launcher into their face.
Yeah. And in that, in the scene where they're sort of sneaking into the, Tommy and Hawk are sneaking into the castle, they use this, this like a very loud method of getting in there, which I found hilarious, because like obviously they're not the most sneakiest cat burglars, are they? And they've got a great scene of where they just making their entrance.
Go for it.
I'm thinking of using the 7-iron.
Looks long, Junior.
6-iron?
Bingo.
Thank you. 4!
4? Did anybody hear something?
I heard something.
It's just like so loud. Well, the loudest entrance for cat burglars.
Yeah, I think by this point they're just kind of fed up. Like, they're just like, I'm tired of doing it the whole sneaky way. Let's do this. Although they are singing a song again, because they're both together again. They're singing side by side.
Yeah.
So they're singing like, they're doing side by side and just enjoying it while they're just literally blowing up this castle into loads of tiny pieces.
So, side by side?
Da-da-da. Oh, we ain't got a barrel of
money. We may be ragged and funny, but we'll travel along.
Hit it, Eddie!
Singing a song. Side by side.
And then, yeah, they get it. It all leads up to the scene where they for some reason, only Hawk has the ability to join these crystals together.
Somehow. Like, apparently he read them up.
With ease to set the machine, the Da Vinci's machine off to make the gold. And then you get the... but he does it slightly wrong, doesn't he? Deliberately. So that it will backfire.
He takes out the one little extra crystal from there.
Yeah. And then... So that sort of causes some kind of explosion. Then you get a fight scene between him and Alfred.
Yeah.
Who gets decapitated by his own knives.
Hey, Alfred. You won't be attending that hat convention in July.
Do you see what I mean? Like, if it would have been cool if it was a swashbuckler, maybe a stab in the stomach, but like not graphic or whatever. You know, like you can get away with a man getting stabbed if you don't show it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he gets decapitated, and then he fights the dog.
Yeah, it's so weird. And they escape from the scene. Yes. Adam McDowell and Bruce Willis escape on Da Vinci's flying machine. So that's another iconic shot from the movie. I think that was on the poster, like them in the glider type of thing. So that's kind of a visually kind of an iconic escape kind of scene. And then they're all sort of like wondering, they're kind of walking off thinking, yeah, we've escaped this, but they're thinking they're sad about Tommy. But so
Tommy's dead.
So it ends on this.
Go on.
I just wish Tommy were here.
No way.
That's not very nice.
No way! Yes, way!
He's alive!
Did I miss anything? Did you miss anything? You're supposed to be all crashed up at the bottom of the hill!
Airbags! Can you fucking believe it?
Have you blown up into fiery chunks of flesh?
Sprinkler system set up in the back! Can you fucking believe it?
How many times do you say that?
That's probably what happened!
Drink it, Captain.
That's probably what happened!
Hey. Drink your coffee.
There you go. Drink your cappuccino. Drink your coffee.
He finally gets a cappuccino! Finally! And that is the end
joke. When the world saved and the secrets of Da Vinci protected, Eddie finally got his coffee.
Would you like to swing on a star?
Jesus Christ. So
I know, I like the way as well, it really emphasizes the whole coffee thing, because it does that whole old school freeze frame, doesn't it? He has the coffee and then he throws the cup off into behind him and it freezes on that and then goes into the credit song.
One of the things I like about that scene is because it seems like they may not have had the budget to film how he properly escaped. So it was funny when he said, like, well, this is what happened, and this is what happened. I love how Bruce Willis, yeah, that is what happened. Let's not ever talk about this elaborate escape plan again.
Yeah,
yeah, I believe you, basically.
And also adding to the whole cartoon element, Tommy Fivetone emerges when they see him in the distance, and he's like just got soot on his face, like he's been in an explosion and he's only got soot on his face. Is that's kind of the level of cartoon you're talking about? Like,
right, do you know what, I know I usually want to do a bit of spiel and so on and talk about like about the critical responses and stuff like that, but I think we should just go right into the trashometer with this one. What do you think, Ed?
I think so.
Trashometer.
Thank you. If this is the first time listening to us, welcome, and thank you for joining us along when we try and reviewing the Hudson Hawk. We review things a little bit different, right? We don't do like letter ratings or star ratings or numbers. We do something called a trashometer. The trashometer basically is a 5 sort of scale thing where basically it tells us how much trash how much we're enjoying the trash. Because a good bad movie, and Ed, you'd agree here, it needs to be a balance of good and bad, where the good stuff and the bad stuff, and even the bad stuff that can become good again, sort of balance itself out so you can have an enjoyable experience.
Yeah.
If it's too much bad, if it's too much bad, it's no longer a good bad movie, it's just a bad movie. If it's not bad enough, it's not really a trash movie now, isn't it? So this is where we go with. We start off at tame. Tame means basically we got bored. It wasn't fun. It was more boring than anything else. Like there really wasn't anything we've called trashy or not even good. It was just a bit bland. And we've had a few of those, like movies like Doom, for example, was a tame, which was a very much a surprise. Then we go into tiny bit trashy. Tiny bit trashy means there are some nuggets here. There are some moments of trashy goodness. There are some silly things. There are some things that we like. But it could have been more. There's a lot of potential there that could have been better if we just, you know, if they just kind of were ballsy enough to go in a certain direction. Then there is trash, which is the perfect combination. It's the golden goose. It is the ultimate find. It is the perfect heist caper. Mwah! Right in the middle, right? Chef's kiss. Then you've got too trashy. Too trashy means that while it's got good nuggets, we're getting more annoyed at it. We're starting to feel a little bit offended by it. We're thinking like we're not having that much fun anymore, but not in a boring way. We're just thinking, we're starting to get a bit of a sit here. I'm not really enjoying it, whatever. And then at the very top is torture. Torture means that it was an absolute torture to sit through, basically. It wasn't fun. It was all bad. We found the whole thing a horrible experience, and we don't want to ever sit through that again. So, I'm going to find this. This is going to be quite an interesting one to discuss here, because when I come back, I'm going to go a little bit to the critical responses. But, Ed, what do you think? Where should Hudson Hawk be on the trashometer?
You know, sometimes I have trouble classing these movies and ranking them. This one's fairly easy for me. I would rank it as too trashy because there's only slight elements I think work, like the comedy crime caper type stuff. I love that. A lot of this movie is just it's too much in the wrong direction from what I want. So it's easy to just class it as too trashy.
And you
as
know
simple
what?
As that, really.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. And that's what's good about it. I had a couple of mixed decisions for me. I actually was jumping back and forth between two, and I'll explain why in a minute. Looking back at the... I'm going to look back very quickly at the critical response to this movie, how everyone gave it really badly results. Like, for example, on Rotten Tomatoes, it's 33%. It's about 4.5 out of 10. Siskel and Ebert gave it two thumbs down, calling the whole thing a complete disaster, where every line starts from zero and gets nowhere. And Siskel even says, even though there's a few funny moments and further on, salvaged by Willis and Aleo, has been the only zany characters against a cast of straight men as opposed to a cast full of overacting where everyone's trying too hard to make everyone a funny line. It feels off. Now, I'm going to say this, and I agree with a lot of the things they're saying. It's overwhelmingly a dislike. Things just don't feel to work. There's too much thrown on the screen. It feels like hubris. It is a passion project that's gone too far. Before I came onto here, I was going to put it on Tiny Bit Trashy, and there's a reason why. This is my original choice.
Yeah.
Because as I was watching it, halfway through the movie, I accepted the fact that this movie is an absolute tonal mess and just went all over the shop. To the point that I wasn't even angry anymore. I got bored. To the point that as I was watching it, I was on my phone just going... like it basically like you lost me movie, like you've lost me, like you've actually lost me. In terms of my attention and appeal, it's kind of weird, isn't it? Because for me, like and here's the thing though, looking back and now what we discussed and how slightly annoyed I was getting, I would put this on too trashy, because it feels like if you didn't let it wash over you, there's two ways you could approach this movie. You can either say it's too much for you and just ignore it, which means by that point you're not even interested in the movie anymore, which is not great. Or you get frustrated at the fact that there's potential in this movie, like all the heist stuff, for example, and the musical numbers and the chemistry between Willis and Leo. And you're sitting there going like, and you're thinking there like, there is potential here. If they only picked one thing instead of five, basically, and made that work, this would have actually been a really good movie. It would have actually been a fun movie, and it would have shown Bruce Willis's quirky side without being too quirky. So, I am thinking more. I am more annoyed at the potential here, I think, than bored by it. So maybe this is on Too Trashy, but it feels like it's right in the middle of Too Trashy, like right in the middle of it, where you can see you're getting annoyed at, but mostly because you're disappointed at the movie. And you know for a fact there's a good movie in there somewhere if someone just had the gumption to just tell Bruce Willis to stop.
Yeah, I mean, they're the only two ranks I would have considered. Like, I wouldn't look yeah. any... Like, it's either Tiny Bit or it's either Too Trashy. There's nothing in... No other option.
And that's the thing, is like, I was going for Tiny, but I'm going to go for Two, mostly because it feels like this is a movie with a lot of potential. And if it was... If someone rewrote this now and gave it a single tone rather than multiple, this could have been actually a really fun movie and got rid of some bits and made things a lot better. So, yeah, I think that this would go into Too Trashy.
Yeah.
Too Trashy.
Thank you. It's right up there. My goodness. So yeah, that was our Bruce Willis tribute, which is kind of a shame, really, because we kind of egged him throughout the movie. Although I would argue that it's not entirely all him. I do feel like this movie it's Bruce Willis having his heart out, him and Robert Kraft just having their heart out for a passion project idea they've always wanted to put on screen, and it just doesn't work. It's undercooked, it's overcooked and undercooked, it's boring and banal, it's everything all at once. But I will now tease this. Actually, I don't usually tease the next episode, but because usually we're going to wrap up, this is where we do our plugins, where we talk about some of the latest things that's happening both on the podcast and on our YouTube channels. But I'm going to actually tease a couple of future episodes of the podcast. I'm going to do that now. I'm going to get it ready because next month is June. So basically, by that point, is around June. So basically, it's Pride Month around that time. So we're going to have a couple of specials. Ed, this is the first time I'm telling you this, so get ready.
Okay.
We're going to do a camp classic.
Yeah.
It's going to be one that drag queens love for bits. And it's one that you've already used for one of the sound bites for the trashometer.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next episode that Ed and I are going to do together is Mummy Dearest. So...
Ah, cool. Okay. Great.
We're going to do the Joan Crawford movie starring Faye Dunaway and the whole thing with the fucking coat hangers.
No! What? Hangers!
So we're doing Mummy Dearest the next episode because I think we need a palate cleanser. I actually think we need a palate cleanser out of Hudson Hawk.
Yeah, although I did like Hudson Hawk enough to buy it. I've got it on DVD, so it must be something. But yeah, Mummy Dearest, I'm looking forward to that. That'd be good.
Mummy Dearest would be a fun one. And then also, there's going to be another episode where I'm going to be joined by the Their Queer podcast. So in other words, we're joined by the two Liams, Liam James and Liam Banks, where we're going to do fucking Xanadu.
Excellent. Okay, that'd be great, yeah.
We're doing Xanadu. We're going to do an all-queer episode where we're doing Xanadu with Olivia Newton-John and a bunch of disco dancing. Other than that, though, there's not much on my end, other than the fact that there's been a couple of episodes up already of the podcast, including, like we said, like last time, we also put in a new episode of the Not So Trash Reviews, where Sophie Black and I talked about vampirism in cinema using Only Lovers Left Alive, which is doing really well, actually. A lot of people like that episode.
Oh, great. Yeah, it is a really good one. I liked it, yeah. Over on the YouTube channel, on the Retro Rewind YouTube channel, we've got a few things in the pipeline. There's nothing out sort of recently, but I want to do... I'm writing a script for nostalgic albums, and the most nostalgic albums of my life. So I'm going to do that. That's going to be out soon. But also, I want to do... I've been teasing this for a while. Because we've done Hudson Hawk on the podcast, I want to play the Hudson Hawk game... and compare it to the movie and just do one of our... Because we kicked off that series with Batman Returns. Is Batman Returns game better than the movie? Because they had a really good version on the Super Nintendo. So sometimes...
Yeah, we're talking about only the Super Nintendo version. Let's not talk about the Sega Mega Drive version.
Sometimes it creates an interesting debate, especially if the movie wasn't particularly great. You might actually have more fun playing the game than the movie. So it's interesting to like compare them sometimes. So we do. I could either do that together or I might do it on my own, depending on if we can get together for it. But I'd love
to get together for that one.
I'd love to do the NES version of Hudson Hawk. Because that's quite frustrating, that one. So it might be quite funny. It's quite hard to play. It's just like a silly platforming game.
I didn't even know there was a game for it. So that is...
Because I originally played it on the Amiga, which is slightly better than the NES version. When I was a kid, I played the Amiga version on my friend's house. But comparing the NES one against the movie will be very... good fun. I think I'll mostly focus on the game rather than, because we've talked about the movie a lot in the podcast, so it mostly be about playing the game but then talking about how it sort of links in with the movie.
But then at least we can say that perhaps then we can just talk about the best bits of the movie instead of having to go through the whole movie and just say, let's just watch the favourite bits again, please. I think that will be quite fun to do. And also, you know, that's also a time when we talk about Bruce Willis and just our love of Bruce Willis movies, like the good ones. There's loads of good ones we can talk about over there. And yeah, and hopefully we'll be back for another few videos together. It's been a little while since I've gone over, so it will be nice to see if we can get to a couple of videos together then, bud.
Yeah, excellent. That'd be great.
Right, so that's all we got time for this one. Thank you very much for joining us. Just remember, keep an eye on your trash. There might be some treasure in there. See you guys next time.
See you later.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode and hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it around with movie lovers you know, maybe add a star rating or write a good review. All of this helps with the algorithm and provides us with more opportunities to reach the ears to a whole new bunch of bad film fanatics. Want to find out more about us? Then head over to our socials where we provide sneak peeks and up-to-date news on everything nostalgic and trashy. You can find our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages in the description. So please, follow us. See you next time, cinephiles.